from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Extreme weather, environmental migrants, coastal relocation. These will be everyday catchphrases in the next 50 years, says our guest tonight. And it's time to stop denying and start planning. Today, the day the Kyoto Accords go into effect without the United States on board, a call beyond prevention to prepare for the damage that's already been done and its impact to come, rising water, refugees, crop failures, disease, and all that comes with climate change. Tonight on Point, bracing for the global warming that's already on the way. We begin tonight with a look at the Kyoto Protocol. More than 140 countries have signed on to the UN-backed treaty, which requires cutting back on carbon dioxide emissions, so-called greenhouse gases. The U.S., the world's biggest polluter, however, is sitting this one out. While the treaty was once hailed by the Clinton administration, the Bush administration pulled out, saying it would put too high a burden on the U.S. economy. Joining me now from Westchester, New York, is Andrew Revkin. He's an environmental reporter for the New York Times. Andrew Revkin, thanks for being with us tonight.
It's good to be with you.
You've followed the story of Kyoto for a long time. I wonder just what your feelings are on this day, to see it finally come into effect. Does it feel like a big day to you, Andrew Revkin?
It's one of these paradoxes where it's a big day, but it's also a tiny thing. Most of the people who've been studying this issue for a long time recognize that it's essentially a century-scale issue. Kyoto itself is only you need 30 Kyotos, they say, to actually get toward stabilizing concentrations of these heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere. And this is like the tiniest baby step in some ways. But, of course, it's very substantive and big in other ways.
A tiny baby step, and yet you've got some major economies signing on to, through technology and trading, to cut back their emissions by significant percentages, 5%, 6% more?
Yeah, some of that is a little behind those targets. There's sort of a backstory. For example, most of Europe had big cuts in emissions that kind of took place for other reasons, like the U.K., shifted sharply away from coal starting around the time in the 90s when the Kyoto targets were the baseline year for the Kyoto targets. Mm-hmm. And Germany essentially shut down the industry of East Germany, and that's eliminated a lot of emissions. So it's not quite as steep a mountain for some of these countries to climb as it seems. Japan has a big challenge. They're going to have a tough time meeting their market.
A 6% cut they've committed to, as has Canada.
Right. And all of them seem to have basically invested in the idea that by restricting energy use now, which implicitly this does because you can't burn as much coal and oil, mm-hmm. They're going to end up more competitive in the long run against the economies that are staying out of the game. And the U.S. is basically going the other way, saying it's a better bet to not incur costs now and to have a little a competitive advantage in the short run.
Where does it leave the United States in terms of its greenhouse gas emissions, Andrew?
Well, emissions have been climbing relentlessly. The current policy of the Bush administration is to voluntarily, with any mandatory initiatives, to see the growth slow down. But there's no sense, really, that there's much there to make that happen.
So the idea of slower growth is on the table, but never mind actual cuts.
And, of course, slower growth will not get you anywhere toward a stabilized level in the atmosphere, which the U.S. did commit to back in 1992 when the first President Bush signed the original climate treaty.
So when the people who are in this up to their necks look around at what's going on with global warming, India and China coming on, the U.S. sitting this one out, you said they'll need 30 Kyotos to get on top of global warming. Do people believe that will happen?
Well, it'll take a mix of things. It'll take short-term actions to at least many people have said that the innovations that are necessary, the technology innovations that are necessary, will only happen if industry is spurred to really start thinking seriously about curbing emissions. And they say you need a cap. That's why some in the Congress have been pushing for legislation along those lines. Now, there are others who say just throw some money at it, that you can, if you just sort of add... There are others who say that, just push an R&D program and things like solar and nuclear, and maybe you'll get there. But it probably is an all-of-the-above kind of situation.
All of the above. But is there confidence that at some point global warming gets reversed, or are we just headed onto a hotter and hotter planet?
Most of the scientists I talked to about this say that we're in for some significant warming, period. That there's a lot of momentum in this machine, the climate system, and it's there's so much already pushed into the system by the human activities of the last 100 years that we're going to see a lot of change. We're going to see a lot of ice melting. There will be sea level rise. There will be more shifts in Arctic climate and that kind of thing. So some of that's inevitable. And that's why whatever we do, many of the experts involved in this say we have to do more to adapt, to make societies more resilient to climate change.
And no promise of when it may turn around. Andrew Rifkin, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
It's my pleasure.
Andrew Rifkin, environmental reporter for the New York Times. He spoke with me from Westchester, New York. We are talking tonight about climate change and bracing for global warming that is already on the way. You can join the conversation. Do you know where your harbor front, your water supply, your front yard will be 20 years from now? And is it defeatist to talk about the inevitable impact of global warming, or is it necessary at this point for survival? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Mark Hertzgaard. He is author of Earth Odyssey, Around the World in Search of Our Environmental Future. This week, he wrote in an article for the San Francisco Chronicle headlined, "It's Much Too Late to Sweat Global Warming. Time to Prepare for the Effects of Our Ill-Fated Future." Mark Hertzgaard, thanks for being with us tonight.
Happy to be here.
You say that environmentalists have thought it would sound defeatist to talk about what's definitely coming. Politicians don't want to say it because they then have to do something about it. What's coming down the pike that's been so forbidding that people don't even want to talk about it, Mark?
The view of the world's top climate scientists, as expressed through the so-called IPCC, that's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. That's about over 2,000 scientists that the UN has pulled together. Over the last 17 years, they have conducted the largest peer-reviewed scientific inquiry in history looking at climate change. And their findings are getting increasingly solid and alarming. And what they say is that not only has climate change already begun, it's not a long-term, far-off possibility. It is happening now. It has happened a lot sooner than we expected. Humans are largely responsible for it. And the other thing is that it's going to get worse before it gets better. And that's because of something that Andrew Rifkin just mentioned. There's a lot of momentum in the system. These greenhouse gases, especially carbon dioxide, which is the main greenhouse gas, stays in the atmosphere for 50 to 100 years. So it's not like you just sort of flick a light switch and you can stop global warming if we just stop burning so much fossil fuel. So Kyoto, I agree, is a tiny step forward. But it is it doesn't deal with this part of the problem. Kyoto only deals with future emissions, and it is humanity's past emissions that have got us into the trouble we're going to be facing over the next few years.
And, of course, there's a lot of emissions still going on right now and a future that stretches out a long way. It doesn't mean, as you say, that prevention can be set aside. But you write that prevention is no longer a sufficient option, that we need also kind of protection. Protection against what? What are the kinds of things that the planet, that individual countries, states, individuals need to begin planning for, thinking about?
You can divide them into two basic areas. One is rising sea levels, and that is because as the planet gets warmer, the oceans will expand, water expands when it warms up. And second, because of the warming temperatures, also you're going to see the ice, glaciers and so forth, will begin to melt. And so sea levels will rise. And that's one whole area where we've got to get ready against. And second, we will see a lot more extreme weather events, more hurricanes, more droughts, more cold snaps as well. It's a bit of a misnomer to say global warming. It's really climate change that we're talking about here because we'll see more extreme weather of all kinds, more drought, but also more rain, and the rain will come in downpours rather than evenly spaced throughout the seasons. So in that regard, we've got to, we saw what happened very tragically with the Indian Ocean tsunami, which was not caused by global warming, but you had a natural disaster there where people were caught unprepared, and we saw many, many thousands dead and many more injured and property damage and so forth. There's going to be many more of those kinds of natural disasters in the years ahead, and so we've got to prepare ourselves against it.
Mark, it's not as though nobody's talked about these things. I mean, for heaven's sakes, at this point there have been Hollywood movies about New York freezing over and all the rest. So what's the message you're putting out there? People know that global warming, climate change, comes with dangers and costs. Is it your sense that governments, that populations don't have an acute enough, a material enough sense of what it will mean and how soon it will mean it?
Partly. I think there's two parts to that. One is that most of the discussion in this country is very backwards compared to the rest of the world. We have been delayed in our understanding of this by, unfortunately, by a very well-financed propaganda campaign by the fossil fuel industry, and now picked up by the Bush administration, which denies this problem. So we've got ostriches in power in Washington, D.C., and unfortunately, much of the press has followed that point of view. And then secondly, even when you do have people, and I think Andy Revkin is one of them, who's done a pretty good job in the New York Times of writing about this, most of the discussion has focused on the long-term prevention of climate change. If we do X, we can prevent this happening in 20 years. And that is true as far as it goes. We do have to worry about the long term. But what has gotten lost, and what was the point of my article, is that because we waited so long to deal with this problem, we are already going to be stuck with a certain amount of global warming, and we have to figure out how to ride out that storm.
It's on the way. Mark Kurtzgaard's talking about flooding, landslides, power outages, crop failures, disease, hunger, poverty. You can join us tonight as Kyoto kicks in without the United States. We're talking about bracing for the global warming that is already on the way. Is it time to stop hand-wringing and start building the ark? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight as Kyoto kicks in without the United States about bracing for the global warming that is already on the way, about environmental refugees, megastorms, cities underwater, drought. You can join the conversation tonight. Is it time to start building the ark? Is everybody talking about a distant threat, but not about the clear and present danger? And do you understand what the impact of global warming, climate change, will be on your state, your town, your life, and what about your children's lives? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from San Francisco by Mark Kurtzgaard. He's been writing about this. He's author of Earth Odyssey, Around the World in Search of Our Environmental Future. We're joined right now from Boulder, Colorado, by Kevin Trenberth. He is head of the Climate Analysis Section of the National Center for Atmospheric Research. He's a lead author of the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in 2001 and also a lead author on the forthcoming report coming out in 2007. Kevin Trenberth, thanks for being with us tonight.
I'm pleased to join you. Thank you.
So we've got a lot of citizens watching on as this Kyoto debate has taken place. Meanwhile, the warming goes on. It continues to go on. We hear from the U.S. The Pentagon is planning for what they call interlocking catastrophes, mega droughts, mass starvation, even nuclear war as countries like China and India battle over water supplies, river valleys, sources of food and water. What is the scientific explanation here, Kevin, for what's going on that could lead to what kind of results?
Well, global warming is certainly occurring. The composition of the atmosphere is clearly changing. The amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has gone up about 32% from pre-industrial levels, and this relates directly to the emissions into the atmosphere, which comes primarily from the burning of fossil fuels. And the U.S. contributes about a quarter of that contribution at the current time. And it's the developed countries which have contributed most in the past to that change in composition of the atmosphere. So these greenhouse gases, as they're called, act to warm the planet. And so I think global warming really refers to global heating. But what that does, a lot of people immediately think, well, that's an increase in temperature. But in fact, most of that heat goes into evaporating moisture over the oceans, which is most of the planet. There's plenty of water around, and we have, as long as we have water around on land, the water acts as an air conditioner, and This is, of course, the way in which the human body works. The way in which you keep the temperature of the human body constant is by evaporation of moisture from the skin. This is the sweating process, perspiration, and it works remarkably well. And planet Earth controls its temperature in much the same way. And so if there's more evaporation of moisture, it puts more water vapor in the atmosphere. We can measure that. There's been an increase of somewhere between about 8 and 15% moisture in the atmosphere. The humidity is increasing over the United States in the past 30 years. And this feeds the storms. It means that when it rains harder. There's more likelihood of floods in this situation, even heavy snowstorms. And in places where it's not raining, things are drying out, and so this is what gives rise to droughts. And I do think the biggest pressure point on society will very likely be water and water management.
Kevin Trenberth, Mark Hertzgard says that environmentalists and politicians have been kind of gilding the lily here, not wanting to alarm or upset the population or be forced to do something by describing what's on the way. So, I mean, we've heard a lot of this before, but when you look at it that way, the question comes again. You're the scientist. Are the changes that are already in the pipeline and the warming or climate change that's likely to continue to come, with all that, is life as we know it going to go on? Will it survive, or are we looking at a drastically changed planet?
Of course, that depends a lot on your time scale and what really does happen in the future. But we're certainly, I don't think we can stop global warming from happening. Climate change is going to continue. Even if we were to prevent any further emissions, what we've already done would increase the global mean temperature by best part of about 1 degree Fahrenheit as we move into the future. So climate change will continue to occur. And, of course, we can't stop emitting because the infrastructure that we have for dealing with our whole way of life depends on that infrastructure. There is a very strong link, however, between climate change and energy in this case, and so it very much relates to the generation of energy. And so it depends on what happens in the future. The differences around the world with regard to energy use are interesting in this regard. And this relates a lot to the structure of the Kyoto Protocol, the fact that only the developed countries are committed to binding targets. And so the United States, the emissions per capita, per head of population, are about 10 times what they are in China and about 20 times what they are in India. But, of course, these countries are industrializing in the process, burning more coal, generating electricity, and they have a target, of course, of bringing electricity to all their people so they have lights at night and refrigerators, which is a very admirable target. You can't argue with that.
And they say they're due the chance to have that kind of development. The developed world already had it. They want their bite of the apple.
That's correct. And so the key question is whether they can do it in a way which is less polluting, which probably needs help from the developed countries, and that's a part of the Kyoto Protocol also, and whether we can increase our efficiency, cut down the waste, spur innovation to reduce the amount of emissions going into the atmosphere in the future. I don't think we can stop global warming, but we can slow it down, and I think that's a very desirable thing to do.
And with all those demands, as Mark Hertzgard says, there's still already a lot that's in the pipeline that is at this point inevitable. Mark, I wish you'd describe to us in very material terms. You're saying brace for this, get ready. So what are the key threats, what are the key measures that countries around the world, including the United States, need to be looking out for and responding, taking?
Let me respond to that by citing the analyses of the insurance industry. The insurance industry has been the one who ends up paying the bills for increased hurricanes and droughts and so forth. And they have been awakened to this problem about 10 years ago. Actually, the Greenpeace activists went and tried to say to the insurance industry, look, climate change is going to be a big money loser to you. And so the insurance industry took notice and even began taking out advertisements in newspapers talking about this problem. Now, Munich Re, which is the world's largest reinsurance company, what that means is that they insure the insurance companies. Munich Re is saying that climate change is going to cause increasingly large catastrophic losses. And Swiss Re, another big giant insurance company, says $150 billion worth of losses a year, every year, beginning in this decade. That's going to mean so property destruction houses lost, people's livelihoods out of whack. That's what we're going to begin seeing, and also, as was mentioned, rising sea levels.
So what does that mean in terms of measures? One phrase that comes out of all this is coastal relocation.
Yes, coastal relocation.
Meaning what? For whom? How widespread?
Well, let's see. You guys are up in Boston, so you probably have listeners who have houses out there on the Cape.
And we'll have listeners right up and down the Atlantic and Pacific coast. So
yeah,
give us the big picture.
You know, they had better reconsider their long-term property plans because already those oceans and seafronts are eroding.
Long-term as in what? Are we talking 10 years, 100 years?
Again, that is, I think, Kevin Tremberth would be a better source on the exact number of years. But look, it's already begun. It has already begun in a number of those areas. I remember there's a very good piece in the New York Times Magazine about 4 years ago, about written by a fellow who had a place out there, and over the last 5 years, the foundations on his house had basically been, the land beneath it had been eroded away. So this is an ongoing thing, and in various different places it's proceeding at different rates.
Another buzz phrase you've got here, you're saying we're going to live with this, environmental refugees, meaning what?
That's going to be a situation where many of the low-lying populations who live in low-lying regions are going to be flooded out. And that one very good example is Bangladesh, very low-lying country, basically a delta country. And as the water rises there, those people are going to be forced out. A smaller example, the Pacific island of Tuvalu, which is very it's only got 12 feet above sea level, is the highest level on the island. That got hit by 10-foot killer waves last year. And not only did that devastate a lot of their buildings, it also meant that their fresh water supplies were inundated with salt water, so their crops don't work. So
they'll need to go somewhere else at some point.
People are going to be leaving.
And therefore, environmental migrants, environmental refugees. I want to turn to our callers a lot when I join this conversation. Susan is calling from Kill Devil Hill, North Carolina, in the Outer Banks there. Hi, Susan. You're on the air.
Hey. Thanks. I'm about a half a mile from the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
How long do I have and where do I go?
How high is your house, Susan?
Well, I'm on pilings. My first floor is, where most people's second floor is.
Okay.
But, once people find out, you're not going to sell your property, right?
Well, I'm sure that's on a lot of people's minds if they have property near the coast. Kevin Tremberth, I mean, here's somebody with a house. It's half a mile from the Atlantic on the Outer Banks in North Carolina. A conversation like this can be upsetting. What do you say to Susan there?
Yes, well, sea level rise is mostly felt when a combination of things occur. So you have a high tide on top of the sea level rise, and you have a storm surge at the same time. And that's the sort of thing which suddenly causes major inundations.
Well, she knows that, but she wants to know whether or not to hang on to this property.
Well, the current rate of sea level rise is about an inch every decade. It's not a huge amount. Sea level rise ultimately is a really long-term problem, more on a century timescale problem. But there will be these episodes around the coast, and it'll just depend on luck as to whether a major storm occurs at the time, a major hurricane occurs, or other storm occurs with a storm surge at the time of high tide. We were very lucky with the last hurricane that came ashore in the Gulf of Mexico that, in fact, it didn't come ashore at high tide. Otherwise, the flooding would have been a great deal more extensive.
But we're trying to get as concrete as Mark Hertzgaard's tone here. And at that level, you know where the Outer Banks are, and you know they're not very high. I mean, people are trying to assess what this means. If it's inevitable, there's going to be global warming, gradual ocean level, sea level rise. Does it doom geography like that, or is there still a chance that this will recede as an issue before, she's got the starfish on her bathroom windows?
Well, it does. I mean, I think the way to really look at it is that their vulnerability is certainly increasing. The best example I can give, actually, is what happens during El Nino events. And on El Nino events, the sea level goes up about 8 inches along the coast of California in a big El Nino event. And so in 1997-98, what that did was cause substantial erosion. There were a lot of pictures of houses toppling into the ocean, and indeed, those houses were doomed. What you can do around some coastal areas is do what they do in the Netherlands and build dikes. And in fact, we do that already in the United States in the Gulf Coast region around New Orleans, where there is a subsidence. The ground itself is sinking, and that's also a problem in Tuvalu, by the way. So it's not just sea level rise. It's the fact that the ground is sinking at the same time. But you can build dikes if you've got enough resources to do that, and you can help gain some level of protection. But still, there is infiltration of saline waters into the water supply, and there are other effects as well. It's many other countries and places like the Everglades and probably the Outer Banks, actually, which are very vulnerable, and sooner or later you'll probably get hit.
Susan, that doesn't sound too great. Build a dike. I'm sorry we can't be more specific, but I'm sure you're watching that water. I want to turn right now to Fairbanks, Alaska. We're joined there by John Walsh. He's professor of climate change at the University of Alaska at Fairbanks, chief scientist at the International Arctic Research Center. John Walsh, thanks for being with us tonight.
Glad to be here.
For many of our listeners, this may still seem like something in the future, but in Alaska, you're kind of our early warning system up there. Global warming, climate change is already creating real problems, material problems. Like what, John?
Well, there's been a significant warming over the past several decades, and there have been some implications for the coastal communities and for the permafrost situation. But just to give you a feel for the magnitude of the temperature change, in interior Alaska, that includes cities like Fairbanks and Bettles, the warming over the last 50 years has been 4 degrees, that's Fahrenheit. Mm. But in the wintertime, the warming has been between 8 and 9 degrees Fahrenheit. And it's somewhat ironic that the warming has occurred, a warming of that magnitude has occurred where it is somewhat welcome. The average temperature is about minus 10 during the wintertime here.
So you've still got a deep freeze. It's not. Is it disrupting human or animal life in Alaska, or it's manageable?
Well, during the wintertime, the impacts are positive in the sense that people and animals can be outside more often. But if you think what an 8 or 9 degree warming would do if it occurred elsewhere, especially in the summer part of the year, you start to realize that the consequences could be substantial. And we are seeing some consequences in Alaska. The sea ice that surrounds the western and northern part of the states is retreating. It's retreating earlier, and it's not forming as quickly in the fall, and it's thinner when it does form. There are coastal communities that used to be sheltered or buffered by the sea ice cover. The sea ice suppresses the waves. Now these communities have open water on their doorstep, so when storms come along in the summer and fall months, there are waves and flooding and coastal erosion more often than they used to experience in the past. The erosion is made worse by the thawing of the permafrost, and the net result is that several communities along the Alaskan coast are now in the process of planning relocations.
Does this feel like a taste of what's to come for the lower 48, John? Are you out there on the frontier seeing what's coming?
I think this part of the country, and it is part of the U.S., does bear watching in the sense that it can be somewhat of a bellwether. Now, climate models do project that with greenhouse warming, the polar regions will warm more and they'll warm sooner than the middle latitudes. So we may well be seeing the early signs here, but some of the problems that are being faced by coastal communities are similar to what we were just talking about with the building of dikes. The dike option is not particularly viable here. The communities along the West Coast are actually going to move. The holdup at this point is who's going to pay for the relocation.
To a lot of costs that come right along with the change. John Walsh in Fairbanks, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
John Walsh at the University of Alaska. Mark Hertzgard, that seems like a very practical example of what you're talking about. The future is now in Alaska.
Sure. Not only in Alaska, but you know, we've had terrible droughts in the West and the Midwest in recent years. And here in California, we had that tragedy last month of a landslide, a mudslide, that occurred after very, very strong, intense rains in which mud poured down the hillsides near Santa Barbara and buried children alive and killed, I think it's now up to 11 people. This is the kind of thing, in addition to, and I understand what you're talking about in terms of the caller's concern about rising sea levels, but, you know, I live near the coast here in Northern California, and I'm more concerned about those storms and what they do to trigger mudslides.
Mark Richgard in San Francisco, Kevin Trenberth in Boulder, Colorado. Please stand by. We're talking about bracing for global warming. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. As Kyoto kicks in today, without the United States, we're talking about bracing for climate change that's already on the way. You can join the conversation tonight. Do we have the breadth of mind to deal with prevention and protection at the same time? Who will pay the piper politically when the trouble really hits the fan? How will you explain to your grandkids why more wasn't done sooner? And do you believe it will be bad, or are you still buying Hummers? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from San Francisco by Mark Richgard, author of Earth Odyssey Around the World in Search of Our Environmental Future, and from Boulder, Colorado by Kevin Trenberth. He is head of the Climate Analysis Section at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. Right now from Frankfort, Kentucky, Lynn is calling. Hi, Lynn. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I don't dispute at all that we are seriously polluting our environment, especially the United States, and that we need to save as much as we possibly can. And I think it's absolutely disgraceful that the United States is not part of the Kyoto Plan.
Okay.
I think you have to be blind, deaf, and bush to think that this is not a problem. But on the other hand, I have a little learning in geology, and as they say, a little learning is a dangerous thing. So I hope
we know that.
So I hope that your guests can clarify this for me. It was my impression that paleoclimatologists claim that the Earth has always been much warmer than this, except for, say, the last 100,000 years when we've been going through a cycle of ice ages, and that we are, in fact, coming out of an ice age, which means that the global warming is a natural and inevitable thing.
And not necessarily man-made.
Well, it must be partly man-made. I think there is enough evidence to indicate that it is being contributed to by men, but that it is also a natural thing and will continue. So are these efforts that we are attempting to make in the Kyoto Treaty and so on and so forth, are they going to have any effect? Is it actually going to be possible to reverse this, or are we faced with a global phenomenon that human beings are helpless against?
Whatever happens. You mean sort of riding the big long wave. Lynn, let us pick that up, and thanks for your call. Kevin Trenberth, that sounds like your neck of the woods. Are there big waves here, which are taking us toward a warmer climate, a changed climate, even without greenhouse gases and the efforts of Kyoto notwithstanding?
Well, let me correct a couple of things that the listener mentioned. Firstly, the change to the sort of ice age, the quaternary, so to speak, was really more like 2 million years ago, and we've had a number of glacials and interglacials in between times. The last major glacial period, when we had the Laurentide ice sheet over North America, for instance, was peaked around 20,000 years ago.
Okay.
The last 10,000 years, we've been sort of in a climate somewhat similar to what we have today. And the best estimate, I mean, the main reason for the fluctuations back and forwards on 20 or 10 to 100,000 year timeframes is simply because of the orbit of the Earth around the Sun, the precession of the equinoxes, the change in the tilt of the axis of the Earth, the change in the shape of the Earth's orbit, the eccentricity, so to speak, of the Earth's orbit around the Sun. And so those are well-defined quantities, and we can calculate those very well. And the best estimate at the moment is that we're actually in a slight cooling cycle. It would be a very slight cooling, perhaps over the last 1,000 years or so. But the effects are not very strong at the moment, one way or the other. We're certainly not in a warming cycle, and the main reason we're warming is because of the increases in greenhouse gases in the atmosphere.
So you're bringing it back to man-made effects, but I guess the question within that is something about what band of temperatures life on Earth can justly expect to live within. Are we too, you know, infatuated with the band that we've known? Are we unrealistic in desiring to stay in that band with everything that's supported in time as we've known it?
Well, I think the key thing here is that on geological timescales, and in particular on 10,000-year timescales, which is when all of these major changes in the past have occurred, are indeed very long. And so we can adapt to these things. Humans, mm-hmm. in fact, can move around. The lifetime of a tree or an ecosystem might be, even for a major tree species, would be of the order of 100 years. And so the seeds grow and take root in some other place, and things gradually evolve with time.
But when you start talking decades, it's another matter. It's hyperspeed.
That's the key point. It's the rate of change right now, which is exceptional in terms of the geological record.
And Mark Ritzgard says it's coming at us with all of its impact. Steve's calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks. I work with the North Carolina Coastal Management Program, mm-hmm. involved in policy and planning. And one of the things that we grapple with as policymakers, with the huge pressures we have for development and so forth,
yeah.
is just the idea of, I think there's a lot of realization in this state and other adjoining states that climate change is happening, but just particularly when it comes down to sea level rise, what are the numbers that I can expect? The woman that was on earlier on the mm-hmm. Outer Banks, if you look at the state of North Carolina, the northern part of our state is very different than the southern part of our state. So a one-foot change there or a three-foot change is a huge difference.
And you're talking about planning major developments. You've got a lot riding on this. You need to know, but it sounds like it's hard to know. How to find out?
Well, just the magnitude of how much is coming. I mean, our rule of thumb is close to what I heard you guys talking about earlier, a foot per century. Is that something that, I mean, I know you guys don't have your crystal balls, but that's the thing that policymakers, we need to know. Again, I think there's plenty of information out there that we all know, that we're full of science out there that says it's happening.
But how much?
How much? Because then I could better plan. Do I relocate? Do I do dikes? Do I publicly do, you know, a lot of education? So
got it. Steve, let us pick it up. Kevin Trenberth, that comes back to you, I think. And there's the planner for the coast up and down North Carolina. He wants specifics. How much is this sea going to rise?
Well, the past century, the rise in sea level was about 6 inches as a whole. The last 15 years, which is when we've got satellites up that are measuring the global ocean very accurately, there has been a rise in sea level of 1.25 inches. There is a little bit of an acceleration, therefore, in the perceived rate. In the IPCC 2001, the best estimate was that around the year 2100, the sea level rise would be somewhere around just over a foot or something like that.
And do you feel confident in that, or is that just a best guess kind of number?
There's quite a large range. It could easily be 2.5 to 3 times that value, or it could be as little as half that value is about the range.
So there's a range, but it sounds like no one's going to know once change gets going, hard to know where it's going to
end. I mean, the main uncertainties here, the biggest uncertainty is, of course, what we will do in the next decade or beyond ourselves. What will we do, in fact, in terms of the changes in the climate? How much effect will Kyoto have? And so that's a key part of it. Part of the uncertainty relates, indeed, to our ability to make really good predictions with our climate models. But that's probably slightly less than half of the total uncertainty.
Let's get one more call here. Pat's calling from Boston. Hi, Pat. You're on the air.
Hi, how's it going?
Oh, it's all right. What's on your mind, Pat?
Well, actually, it follows a little bit along the lines of what the last caller was saying, but doesn't it seem almost fiscally irresponsible to divert funds from things that we know are problems, like, you know, education.
Mm-hmm.
For something that I think the error bars were something like, you know, a degree and a half over 100 years to 5 degrees over 100 years.
So if we can't know exactly what's coming with climate change, why should we be spending money to prepare for it?
And maybe research it, but to actually build dikes, as one person was saying. And it seems like a lot of this evidence is just kind of anecdotal, like to connect the mudslides in California to global warming almost makes me shudder, you know, as a scientist to think that...
You're not ready to tie those two together. Pat, our time is short, but let us pick it up. Mark Hertzgard, there's the counter-argument. We can't know exactly what's coming. We've got immediate dire needs right now, education and all the rest. How can we plow money into the kind of preparation you're advocating when we don't know exactly what's coming and we... You know, the evidence sounds anecdotal to this listener.
There is nobody less sentimental in the world, I think, than insurance companies. And they are virtually unanimous about this, looking at the work of the scientists in the IPCC. This is not anecdotal. As a journalist, I use anecdotal examples to illustrate what scientists like Kevin Trenberth have been analyzing for years. And I think, as a citizen, I'd like to say thank you to him and to so many of these other scientists who have done such yeoman's task in getting this information out there. It is urgent to recognize the point he made that it is up to us to decide how bad this will get. And as far as diverting funds, I think that it's absolutely necessary. You know, it's not... a question of if, it is a question of when. And people are already dying from climate change. We had 20,000 people in the summer of 2003 die from an extreme heat wave in Europe, mainly older people. And there are examples after examples after examples. That's what the insurance companies are looking at. That's why they are trying to get governments and corporations to do something about this.
So the U.S. is not in Kyoto, and Kyoto itself may be a baby step, but in your view, and many others, here comes the change. With that, we are out of time. Mark Hertzgard in San Francisco, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Mark Hertzgard, author of Earth Odyssey Around the World in Search of Our Environmental Future, and Kevin Trenberth in Boulder, Colorado, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Kevin Trenberth, head of the Climate Analysis Section at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In a moment, battling global warming at the local level. This is On Point. With Washington's slowness to take action on greenhouse gas emissions, some states are now trying to force the federal government's hand. Around the country, from California to Rhode Island, Iowa to Massachusetts, states are putting policies in place and bringing cases to court in order to cut the emissions of businesses and automobiles in their own backyards. Three prominent court cases on greenhouse gas emissions and state policy will be heard this year. The first is scheduled to begin in April. Joining me now is David Doniger. He's climate policy director at the Natural Resources Defense Council and is involved in some of the state-level actions. David Doniger, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So give us a sense of what's going on, not at the federal level, but beneath. What should we be keeping an eye on?
Well, there are two big groups of states that are taking action. In the East Coast, from Maine to Delaware, there's a group of states that are working together to set up a cap-and-trade program for the emissions from the power plants in that region. And on the West Coast, Governor Schwarzenegger has set standards for new vehicles, for the greenhouse gas emissions of those new vehicles. And the eastern states are intending to copy those standards as well. So you have these two big state initiatives.
And those two aimed at power plants and automobiles. What's the impact of, auto emissions standards set at the state level if they're not federal?
Well, the California standards can be copied by other states. And in the past, California's leadership has led to the adoption of the same standards at the federal level. So we're hoping that California leads and the feds follow again.
Now, car makers are challenging the California rule in the courts. When will we know if California's tightening goes through?
This legal battle will take a while, but in the meantime, the California standards are getting finished and getting put into place, and car makers, we're urging them to innovate and not litigate. But if they insist on litigating, we at the NRDC are going to join with the state of California and defend those standards in court.
Now, then you've got 11 states and a lot of environmental groups actually suing the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. What are they claiming?
Well, the federal government under the Bush administration took the amazing step of saying that carbon dioxide and the other chemicals that are released into the air and cause global warming, that they're not pollutants and that they can't do anything about them under the Clean Air Act. We think that's dead wrong, and we're taking the federal government to court in the hopes of overturning this ruling that the Clean Air Act doesn't reach any of these problems.
So you've got California, New Jersey, New York, Illinois, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and more all joining on that. When might a decision come down?
We will hear that case in April, and then it takes maybe 3-4 months to hear what the Court of Appeals in Washington has to say about it.
And finally, you've got 8 states and the city of New York taking 5 power companies to court in the South District of New York. What's at issue there?
Well, these 5 power companies are the largest emitters of global warming carbon dioxide in the country. They together make up 10% of all the emissions in the country. The states and the city have taken them to court under a really old theory of public nuisance. You're just not allowed to put pollution into the air that harms your neighbors. And the states are taking these companies to court and asking the court to set a limit that would reduce the carbon dioxide emissions of these power plants.
David, if at the state level and with the environmental groups' efforts in the courts, if all of this should go through, in its effect, would it be equivalent, sort of tantamount, to the United States having joined Kyoto after all, or not, something less?
No, we need action at the national level. And what happens many times is that when the states take the lead and when environmental groups continue to put on pressure in the courts, finally the business community says, you know, we need a uniform federal solution. We've got to have one set of rules. Let's cut a deal in Washington and make some progress there in order to get some uniformity. That's the goal here. It's happened before on clean air issues and energy issues, and it could happen here too.
We've got half a minute. Is it your sense that ultimately American business, as you're suggesting, is going to get on the federal government, see what's going on around the world, and actually become the driving engine behind policy change here or not?
Most of the smart business leaders in these industries know that there have to be limits eventually. And what they're balancing is how hard it is to step up to the plate now with how much harder it will be if you delay and have to do things on a crash basis. More and more of them are coming around to seeing that we really have to do this.
So a lot going on, step at a time. David Doniger at the Natural Resources Defense Council, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jupp, Rachel Dornhelm, Eileen Amata, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Tim Skog, Michael Garth, Leslie Moore Mira, and Mike Toda. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.